Welcome to the Yanks Are Coming Soccer Show. My name is Carter Krishnar. I'm joined as always by Neil Blackman. And we've got with us today a special guest, USSF presidential candidate Mike Vinograd. And I'll lead off here with you. You've put some exciting plans, interesting plans in place in terms of your vision for U.S. soccer going forward. What specifically motivated you to run for president of U.S. soccer at this point?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks a lot for having me on, guys. It's a pleasure. This started, I would think, when I was coaching my kids, probably about 10 years ago when I got involved. My kids were at the rec level, and I started sort of working with the programs here to help make them a little bit better. And then they got involved in the travel program, and it was really an eye-opening experience to see how fractured everything was. It was very hard to figure out, you know, I didn't understand why did I have two passes, you know, why did I need one pass for one game, a different pass for a different game, that pass for another tournament. People said this league's better than that league, but teams from this league beat teams from that league, and that league has six divisions, so how could it be so elite? It was a very confusing, fractured landscape, and that really got me thinking that we need to sort of make things better for the kids. There were a lot of things that just weren't in the kids' best interest in terms of, you know, travel times and whatnot. That really was where it started, and I, like everyone else, I was disappointed when we didn't qualify for the World Cup. That, to me, is really just one game. It was really what led to that. It was years in the making, and I sat down and said, you know, there are a lot of things that we can make better. This is a game that I loved, I played, I coached, I managed my entire life, and I want to make things better.
You obviously. Go ahead, Neil.
Thanks for spending a little time with us today. I truly appreciate it. I think one of the discussions that, and I usually don't even leave with this, so you'll be the first candidate we talk to where I've kind of led with pay to play, which isn't, I think, if I'm being honest, I think it's pretty far down on the list of things that we should be concerned about. But I wanted to get, right, to avoid the situation where these podcasts become, oh, well, I've listened to this and he's already said this. Sure. I think we risk, when we talk about pay to play, we risk saying an answer I think is okay is it's not going away, so we need to find ways to make soccer more accessible, right? But I think, right, the lawyer in me kind of grimaces at that answer, I guess, because there has to be some more nuance to that. So, I mean, is there anything specific you had in mind, maybe as it speaks to pay to play, and then, you know, what role does the U.S. soccer president really have in implementing any of those reforms? Because I think there's a question that's fair about what power the U.S. soccer president has to really implement much change.
So when you think about pay-to-play, and the way I've phrased it is reducing the cost barriers. We're never going to make everything free. That's not the practical, sort of goal, to make, soccer in America free. We need to reduce the cost barriers, both in pay-to-play, when you're talking about young kids getting into the game, and coaching education, when you're talking about young college graduates who want to pursue a business career, but at the same time take a course and help out their community because they just played, 4 years of college soccer and have a lot to offer. There is a practical potential here for U.S. soccer to get involved and help reduce those costs. And look, that's not to say you're going into private businesses and stepping over private businesses and getting into the models where private businesses compete, but there are ways that we can raise money to lower costs and make it more accessible. So when you think about pay-to-play, it's not just the cost, but it's also, are fields accessible? Are there clubs in underrepresented communities? And those are all things that U.S. soccer can do. And I've talked about five different ways that we can help. Now, there are some things like the surplus, where you've at least got some money there that you can use towards this. You've got to invest in teams, making sure you're not leaving public grant money that's available on the table. You need to invest in things like the U.S. Soccer Foundation. The U.S. Soccer Foundation has done this, and it's done it well. I've been a contributor to the U.S. Soccer Foundation for many, many years now because it's a great mission and a great organization. They have figured out that we can get into inner cities, underrepresented communities, and build fields and run programming to bring kids into soccer. And the way that they, one of the ingenious things that they figured out is we don't just have to go to big companies and banks and raise money in that respect to do it, but we could actually go and get municipal funds to do it. We can go to the city of Atlanta and say, you've got money earmarked for infrastructure development. Give that money to us. We'll build fields, we'll run programming, and we'll make soccer accessible to a whole group of folks that just weren't able to play. The fourth thing is raising money in the private sector. And my law firm represents the biggest private equity firms in the world, from Bain Capital to TPG. About 2 weeks ago, I was in London with a client, the CEO of LGIM Properties. LGIM Properties funded the development of St. George's Park, the FA training facility. So those are the kind of folks where I speak their language, and I had great conversations with the CEO of LGIM Properties, and we talked about, you know, U.S. soccer, and can we get that kind of money into U.S. soccer? And the last thing that I've mentioned in terms of making it more of a reality, in terms of reducing those costs and increasing accessibility, is solidarity payments. Now, most people talk about solidarity payments and they think about it as just the money you get if you actually successfully get a player who you developed into, you know, to sign a pro contract. But it's more than that. The idea of a solidarity payment creates an incentive for upfront investments in local clubs at the local youth level. It enables a club to hit a market that we can't get to, that local market, to go to a local business owner, a local resident, and say, hey, give money to our club. Make it easier for us to get kids who may not be able to afford the high cost of soccer these days. Not just because it's the right thing to do, but because if we get it right, like I think we will, you're going to get your money back. And so those are different ways that you can actually make a dent in this and bring those costs down, make it more accessible, bring more players that were not involving in soccer into soccer, and make it more, again, practical for all of those players to continue playing in the game.
I'm so glad you mentioned the U.S. Soccer Foundation, Mike, and elaborate a little further on that for our listeners, because there are a lot of programs they're involved with at the grassroots and inner city level in giving grants and what have you that I think many fans of the sport are not aware of in this country. Talk a little bit about that and what your vision would be for working with the U.S. Soccer Foundation if you're president of U.S. Soccer.
Sure. So, you know, and let me start with way before I knew what the U.S. Soccer Foundation was. When I was managing and I'd started up a pro team in the A-League, the Staten Island Vipers, and I had gone into law school after that and come back, one of the things I'd done for that entire time period was go into schools in the inner cities. It was mostly in Harlem and other places in New York City. And we would go into schools and teachers would allow us to run gym periods and we would coach soccer. And we would have fun and introduce kids to soccer and play. And it was important then because it was the right thing to do and it was just important to me. When I learned about U.S. Soccer Foundation, and that is the charitable arm of U.S. Soccer, it is going into inner cities and building fields, whether they're futsal courts, whether they're courts on top of tennis courts, or whether they're full fields in the cities. And so, you know, I spent some time in San Francisco where my sister lives, and I'd go for a run, and I would run by in some of the parts of San Francisco where there is no access to soccer. You'd all of a sudden stumble upon a great futsal court with U.S. Soccer Foundation logos that they had raised money for and built. And what that field did, and this happened, you know, last summer, ran by, saw the court, came back the next day, went on the court with the soccer ball, and wound up playing pickup with a whole bunch of kids, you know, for a couple of hours. That would never have happened but for the U.S. Soccer Foundation raising funds, identifying an area where there is just no access to soccer facilities, and building a court. That's what they do. And again, when I say, you know, they've done a good job, we need to invest and give them more resources, more staff to do an even bigger job than they're doing now.
These are the sorts of practical things that I think, one thing that you're touching on a lot of this is practical things that U.S. Soccer actually is within its power to do. You know, that we're not panacea for all the problems that caused World Cup qualification failure and so on and so forth. I think it's important in that respect when we talk about investment to talk about the women's game. We just had one of the institutional sort of beacons of women's professional soccer in the United States. The Boston Breakers are going to close shop. Yeah. I mean, there's probably a host of things U.S. soccer can do investment-wise to improve the state of the women's game in the country, which sounds like an odd thing to say since the national team is the world champion. But you're also talking about a closing gap worldwide, whether that's a technical issue or, you know, an equality of facilities issue. What type of role do you see U.S. soccer playing in terms of the women's game if you were to be the president of the federation?
You know, U.S. soccer's role is influential. And you have to remember, U.S. soccer doesn't have the power and shouldn't be involved in you know, running private businesses. You know, private businesses need to ultimately stand on their own. But we need to support them. We need to do what we can. And there are lots of ways that U.S. soccer can do it with respect to you know, the women's game. Let me just start with a couple of quick ideas. So we have the ability, you know, U.S. soccer can be a liaison. U.S. soccer touches on other private businesses, other sections of the landscape, and we need to make sure that to the extent that we can serve as a liaison and bring parties together and help private businesses make deals with one another, that we do that. And whether that is bringing private equity firms and saying, hey, make sure you take a look at the women's game. You know, this is, this is a great model. This is something you should invest in, whether it is pairing the pro leagues, you know, with MLS, as many of those teams have done already, and realizing that, hey, wait a minute, we've got MLS who is stable and has a lot of synergies with us. We have a lot of overlap on the administrative side. We can use them to bring down our administrative costs and use a stable, financially sound model to help us and pair up with MLS. U.S. soccer can facilitate that. U.S. soccer can work with the NWSL and figure out ways to make it more attractive for athletes to join the league. And that's not just, like you said, you know, waving a wand around and sort of saying we're just gonna, you know, get people here, but we can create incentives. So for example, for the last 10 years, I went to Lafayette College, I played there for 4 years, and for the last 10 years, I've had the Lafayette team come to my offices in the city and introduce them to life after soccer. We have about 30 or 40 alums that come every year, and we ask a handful to talk about their career paths. This is what I do, this is how you become what I do. And it becomes a networking night as well. We need to make sure that we are making clear to women who are considering going into the NWSL, hey, listen, do it because it's something you love. Here are all the benefits that you'll get for the rest of your life out of doing this. And by the way, if you do it for 3 years and you decide you want to go on, we've got an alumni network that will help you in life after soccer. And that includes leading by example. It includes making sure that U.S. soccer is bringing women into the front office, bringing women into administration, seeing where we can get women more actively involved in the business of soccer. Those are the kind of things that we can do to help the league get stronger and financially even more stable. And I'll say this about the NWSL, and I've spoken to Amanda Duffy several times, and they're doing a great job. I feel like that league is despite some of the, you know, some of the teams and the issues they're facing, I feel like that league is switching a little bit from survival into growth, and that's a great position to be in.
Let me follow up on that with your own experience in lower division men's soccer with the A-League, helping to found the Staten Island Vipers. The challenges, the drama, the financial pitfalls, any adjective you want to use or any descriptive set of words you want to use to describe lower division men's soccer in the U.S., you can use. And chaos, again, is reigning this offseason. What would you do to bring some more clarity to the Division II and Division III situation if you're U.S. Soccer president?
So again, that is sitting down. First of all, you know, I hope the NASL survives, and I would absolutely get them back Division II status. I don't, you know, it's just not in anybody's interest for them not to have it. But this, again, is where you need to be able to actually be a facilitator. You need to make sure that the league, you cannot dictate to MLS or any other league what it should or shouldn't do. That goes for MLS, USL, the NASL. You know, U.S. soccer doesn't have the power, and it shouldn't just be in the business of ramming things down people's throats. But what you can do is make sure that people understand U.S. soccer's interests and that they're giving those interests due consideration. And so in terms of forming clarity, it's a conversation. You need to be able to get into the room with those business folks and talk about what's in the best interest of U.S. soccer and in their best interest. Because a private business is going to do what's in its best interest. That's its fiduciary duty. But you need to be able to articulate why following a common path is, in fact, in the best interest of a private organization. And while a short-sighted view may say, you know what, I'd rather not do that if I'm the business, you need to make sure folks understand, well, listen, if you want to go rogue and go out on your own, here's what life looks like outside of this umbrella, and that may not be a great path. That's not ramming anything. It's just being able to get into a room with folks and make sure that you're articulating in a persuasive way why the path forward is together and making sure that private businesses give due consideration to the interests of U.S. soccer. Ultimately, private businesses, like I said, are going to do what's in their best interest, and that is their fiduciary duty. We can't change that, but we can have a conversation. And this is what I've done. You know, I mean, I've done this for 17 years. I've been in boardrooms. I've been with CEOs. I've been in cases where you've got tens and tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, and sometimes even billions of dollars at stake. Those are very serious competing interests. And nobody on the other side of the table is going to just do something because they, you know, think you made a nice speech. But if you can actually engender confidence, earn their trust through integrity and objectiveness and fairness and open-mindedness, and then articulate why it is that the common path forward is in fact in their best interest, I think that's how you start to get people to think about clarifying the lower divisions, figuring out the best structure, and talking about things that will help U.S. soccer ultimately in the long run.
We've had, you know, the decade plus of the Gulati leadership style, which has a lot of, I mean, I think lost in some of these, this is just a personal opinion, but lost in some of the criticisms is just an immense amount of progress that's been made under Sunil.
Right.
In a lot of areas.
Right.
But it is sort of a distinctive leadership style that's a little different than your, let's have a chairman of the board who's there to receive sort of sounding board ideas and then sort of guide discussion to productive solutions. I mean, what's your sort of vision of what a U.S. soccer president should be? I mean, is it somebody that's a little more centralized in terms of their control and leadership style like Sunil Gulati, or is it maybe something a little different? And at least from an optics perspective, I think the argument that people make is, well, there's not enough transparency. And I think there's a lot to that discussion, but it's more, to me, the question is more of, you know, what type of leader does the next president perceive themselves to be, because there's a lot of challenges ahead.
Yeah. Well, so let me break that down a little bit. So first of all, I think it's good that you mentioned, you know, everything that Sunil has accomplished, because I've said that repeatedly, right? I mean, we've made great strides. When I look at where soccer is now compared to where it was when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, it's just light years, you know, apart
right.
from one another. You know, if I wanted to watch a soccer game when I was growing up, I either had to get up really early in the morning on Sunday for soccer made in Germany, or, you know, flip through Univision and hope that I stumbled on a game, you know, on Univision. And that was it. So there's no question that we've made a tremendous amount of progress. When you talk about governance style, different people have different styles. And you know, when I look at companies, and I represent a lot of them, and even law firms, they can be run differently. Different people who start, you know, you and I start our own company, they may be just as good as one another, but they're going to be different. You have different personalities, we have different, you know, priorities, and so they're going to differently with different cultures. And that's not to say dictatorships can't be run and you know, well and successful in the business world. I don't think that governance style works in a constituency-based organization like U.S. Soccer. I, by personality and otherwise, and how I've always worked, am a lot more collaborative. I'm a lot more about building a consensus, and I think that's what you need in an organization like this. To answer the rest of your question, which is, what's the role of a president of U.S. Soccer? Now, that's an interesting question, because people talk a lot about how it's unclear. The fact of the matter is, if you read the bylaws, it's not all that unclear.
Right.
The bylaws specifically define what the role of president is. It's to run the board meeting. It's to represent the U.S. in FIFA and CONCACAF, and serve as a director, an ex officio member of the committee. As we know, in nonprofits, that means being the visionary, working with others to come up with a vision, working with others about a process to implement things. It doesn't mean actually executing everything day to day. We have a CEO for that. So when I think of the president, which raises a whole interesting question about the issue of, you know, whether the president should be paid, which is a sort of related but different issue. But when you think about the role of the president, it is to lead U.S. Soccer. It is to lead the board. It is to make sure that the voices of all of the constituents are being heard, and the constituents are being empowered to carry out their own mission. That's the central role, I think, of the president of U.S. Soccer. And it's defined as that. Now, there's going to be a lot of hands-on activity by the president, especially to fix some of the things that have lagged behind or are broken in U.S. Soccer. When it comes to figuring out a structure on a state-by-state basis in U.S. youth soccer, that's not something you can delegate. It's something that the president needs to be involved in, needs to listen, go to our, you know, the state associations are our representatives at the state level, needs to go in, listen to them, listen to folks with boots on the ground who've been living this for decades, and figure out with them and all the other leagues and interested parties in that state, what is the best way to structure things in this state. And again, then it is to get in a room with them and help make it happen. You're not going to be able to delegate something like that. That's going to take a skill. It's something that's, again, the kind of thing that I've been doing for 17 years. If it were easy, I'd be out of a job. So the president's going to have to roll up his sleeves. But, you know, again, the role is defined in the bylaws, and we need to be cognizant of that.
As a follow-up to that, I think you might have answered my question that I had already, but what would you do to restore some degree of balance between Soccer House's mandates and directives and the state soccer associations and their wills, their desires, and quite honestly, their local knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you've got to empower the state associations. You've got to empower the members of U.S. Soccer, right? That's the very first step. It's no different than you know, in a business with an employee. You know, as soon as that employee feels empowered and understands that he or she has discretion to carry things out, he or she begins to take on that active role again. And we need to give power back to the states. So that's the first step. And the second thing is, and I've talked about this as my first key initiative, is we need to make decisions through an inclusive, merit-based, and transparent process. So if we're going to make decisions on birth, you know, birth year registration, if we're going to make decisions to who's going to administer referees, those decisions, from those to substitution rules to double cut, any of that stuff, those types of decisions, if they are percolating up to the U.S. Soccer level, have to be made inclusively. U.S. Soccer doesn't just, you know, you can't just sit in the ivory tower in Chicago, make the decision, and then issue the edict. You need to bring in all those people who the decisions are affecting into the conversation for a lot of reasons. The decision will be better. The product that you come up with will be better. And number two, you've got ownership. People will take ownership over that decision, having been involved in making it. It brings everybody into the fold. It creates confidence. It creates trust. And it winds up, you know, creating a better product.
Cardick?
That's all I had. Do you have anything else?
No, I think that was fantastic.
Yeah, I think you covered everything. So Mike Mittergrad is the candidate. February 10th is the USSF election in Orlando. Best of luck. Thank you for joining us.
Let me ask one quick final, say goodbye question to Mike, which is just let people know if they don't know already where, Google search would solve this, I suppose, but, just where can they find, is there a platform that people could look at or anything of that sort that we could point people towards?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So my website is www.winograduss.com, so WINOGRADUSSF.com, and that's got my initiatives, and it's got some thoughts I've put in on other hot topics and an in the press page where I've tried to put a lot of the press that I've done and the interviews and the features, as well as some of the position papers that various constituents have asked us for, whether it's the athletes or adults. Soccer. So my website's a pretty good source. I'm on Twitter at WinogradUSSF as well. I think both of those are pretty good sources.
So
fantastic. Thank you again for your time.
Yeah, WinogradUSSF is the site. WinogradUSSF.com is the site. Thanks again for your time. And best of luck in this election.
Yeah, thank you guys. I really appreciate your time.